Israel carries out another terror attack in the Syrian capital Damascus, assassinating at least 5 people, including 2 Iranian military advisors. 106 days into U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, a new report reveals at least 2 mothers are killed every hour in the besieged Gaza Strip. An Israeli occupation force has launched fresh raids in several areas of the occupied West Bank, abducting several Palestinians. An Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital Damascus leaves at least 5 people dead and several injured. The attack targeted a 3-story residential building in the city's Mazan neighborhood, which houses several diplomatic missions. Video shows large plume of smoke rising into the air. Israeli media have also hinted Tel Aviv regime was likely behind this strike. The identities of those killed in the attack are still unknown. Attack has reportedly killed 2 military advisors with Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. Israel repeatedly targets Syria with missiles and warplanes. Back in December, a similar strike in Damascus killed senior IRGC commander Sayed Razi Mousavi, who was on an advisory mission at the invitation of the Syrian government. Iran's already warned the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for its criminal acts. Joining us now from the Syrian capital is Ibrahim Wahdi. Try to get more on this developing story. Hello, Ibrahim. What do we know at this point there?
Yes, Danny. We have confirmation that, unfortunately, 2 IRGC advisors were in the building because it's their place of residence. As I said before, this isn't a military or any... There's no any military presence in this area. This is a residential area, completely resident. The IRGC advisors were there because, as I said, it's their home. Unfortunately, they were among the martyrs.
Right, and this is a completely civilian area. And what is the vicinity that the story says there are diplomatic missions? So this is mostly a civilian area, but there are also, what, some embassies there?
Yeah, several embassies. As I said before, also the, for example, one of the embassies, the South Africa embassy, which, as you know, they filed a suitcase against Israel at the ICJ. It's 3 buildings behind the targeted building, only 3 buildings away, among other embassies in the area as well. So it was a high risk that they could have damaged any embassy or attack any other embassy. Also, the embassies around the area reported some material damages, like glass was broken, some minor material damages.
So you mentioned that we know 2 people, 2 of the people, the 5 people killed are with advisors with the IRGC. Do we know if they're there with their entire families, if they were alone? Do we know the other 3 fatalities, who they may have been or what relation they may have had with the IRGC advisors, Ibrahim?
At the moment, there's no confirmed information. What I've seen when I arrived, there are many civilians around the scene at the moment of the explosion. Many civilians came after looking for their relatives in the building. We've seen some emotional cases. People were crying, were shouting, they were searching for their relatives. But as for the IRGC advisors, no confirmation or no information, actually, let's say, at the moment that they were with their families. The initial footage of the scene, and what we've seen from the people, the advisors were mostly alone there, only the 2 advisors.
Right, and do we know, Ibrahim, at this point, you mentioned it was a 3-story building, completely leveled. Do we know if anyone managed to survive the blast and if there were other families in that building at the time of the explosion?
There were other families at the building, unfortunately, and so far, no survivors, only martyrs at the moment. Search team are still searching, the rescue team are searching for the survivors, but And that, I know it's a bit far from there. I've been there like a minute ago. It doesn't seem that anyone could survive this.
Okay, we're talking to our reporter, Ibrahim Wati. There's been an explosion in the Syrian capital, Damascus, a three-story building completely leveled by the Israeli regime. At least five people are deceased. There are also injuries. We do not exactly know how many at this point, but we know that two of the deceased are two advisors with Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps military advisors in Syria at the invitation of the Syrian government. This is one in a series of dozens upon dozens of attacks by the Israelis against the sovereign state of Syria, a gross violation of international law, attacking Syrian soil. The government and Damascus has appealed numerous times to the UN Security Council to put an end to these gross violations of its sovereignty by the regime there in Tel Aviv, all to no avail. You want to give us one more recap, Ibrahim? You mentioned Sayed Razi Mousavi, also martyred by the Israelis in the Sayed Zainab shrine, nowhere near the Syrian capital. So we know that the Israelis, in violation of Syrian sovereignty, have carried out all over Syria similar strikes targeting people that are there, that are friends of Syria, that are there at the invitation of the Syrian government and in the role of helping the country fight off foreign-backed terrorists that were trying to take over the Damascus government for over 10 years. Is that right?
Exactly. Let's go back a little bit in time. A few years ago, if you remember, Samir al-Qantar was responsible for the logistic support for the popular resistance in the Jolan area, was also assassinated the same way in his apartment in Jaramana, which is in Damascus countryside. Also, in the same neighborhood, a few years also, like 2 to 3 years ago, they the Israelis also attacked the same area, destroyed a building. I remember they destroyed the second floor of one building to assassinate a Palestinian faction leader. They couldn't kill him, they killed his son, unfortunately. As also lately happened, the last assassination of martyr commander Sayed Razi Mousavi in Sayed Zainab Shrine, in the vicinity of Sayed Zainab Shrine in Aqraba town, also same, targeting a residential building, where they're targeting, we can see a pattern here. They are targeting the place of residence of everyone they want to assassinate. They're not targeting them at their work, in a military base or something. They always target a residential area where it puts a lot of civilians' lives at risk. They don't care about that. They just want to assassinate. And as we said also before, the Israeli regime now at the moment is stuck. There's the only way for them is to ignite a war. Other than that, they will be sacrificed in any potential political settlement. All we can see at the moment is that Netanyahu sees the only way of his political survival is to ignite a regional war.
Okay, thank you, Ibrahim. Stay in close contact with us. Find out if you can as much as possible. They're on the ground. There's a developing story. We want to keep ourselves completely up to date on what's going on over there. There has been an explosion there in the Syrian capital, Damascus. A three-story building has been leveled by the Israeli regime in a densely populated civilian neighborhood of Damascus, the Meza neighborhood, resulting in at least five fatalities. The complete structure was annihilated. There were families involved. At least two of the deceased that have been martyred are two advisors of the Islamic Republic Guard Corps. Meanwhile, 106 days into the Israeli war on Gaza, and the regime continues with this carpet bombing campaign throughout the besieged territory. Gaza Health Ministry says 165 Palestinians have been killed and over 280 wounded in the past 24 hours alone. Overall death toll from the regime's genocidal war has risen now to nearly 25,000. More than 62,000 have been wounded, and thousands are still missing and presumed buried under rubble of their homes. Israel continues bombing residential buildings and refugee camps in areas that it said would be safe. Hospitals are also overwhelmed throughout the besieged enclave, with people literally waiting on floors for medical care. The deadly raids are being conducted while the coastal territory is under a near complete communications blackout imposed by the regime in Tel Aviv. As the U.S. Managed Israeli genocide in Gaza continues, new U.N. figures indicate women are among the main victims of the regime's deadly carnage. According to U.N. Entity for Gender Equality and Empowerment of Women, also known as U.N. Women, out of the nearly 25,000 people killed in Gaza, some 70% are women and children. UN Women says two mothers are killed every single hour by the Israeli regime's bombing and shelling campaign. Agency says out of nearly 2 million internally displaced people in Gaza, half of them are women and girls. UN Women also estimates at least 3,000 women who may have become widows or heads of households are in urgent need of protection and food assistance. Figures by the agency come as nothing has been done to address the crisis concerning the women of Gaza. According to figures, just 0.09% of UN funding has been directed to national or local women's organizations. The UN says Israel's detained thousands of Palestinians in Gaza since early October when the regime launched its onslaught on the besieged enclave.
During my time here, I managed to meet a number of released detainees. These are men who were detained by the Israeli security forces in unknown locations for between 30 to 55 days. They described being beaten, humiliated, subjected to ill treatment, and to what may amount to torture. They reported being blindfolded for long periods, some of them for several consecutive days.
Sungi said Palestinians are detained in horrific conditions. He said he personally heard accounts of released detainees who said they're beaten up and humiliated. The commissioner also urged the release of those held without charge and called for transparent probe into all instances of torture by Israel. Multiple released Palestinian detainees say they're transferred in trucks to open-air prisons where they suffer different forms of maltreatment.
They took me to the truck, and the truck was crowded with detainees. They practiced the worst types of torture on us. It was a rainy night, so they took us to a northern area and put us on the asphalt. It was raining hard and it was cold. We stayed in the rain for more than an hour, and they beat us while we were tied up.
The freed prisoners also said that they were threatened to be shot and forced to insult Palestinian groups and political figures. Such accounts were backed by footage released by Israeli troops on social media that shows the mistreatment of prisoners. Videos often show blindfolded Palestinians, among them a number of women and children. South African politician and youth activist Mohammed Khalid Said has spoken to us about the Israeli genocide in Gaza, and he explains why he believes the regime is imposing an all-out communications blackout.
This is a genocide. The pictures are here. The death toll speaks to it. But even within that context, the people of Gaza and the resistance and Hamas in particular have put up a brave fight, and they continue to resist. And we want to commend them for that. Without Iran, this particular axis giving support to the suffering people of Gaza and the resistance in Gaza will not be possible. The aim of the Israeli regime in carrying out this particular blackout is so that they can suppress the information coming out of Gaza, so that their crimes, their atrocities, their genocide cannot be sent out to the rest of the world. But still, the information is at our disposal. So that's their objective. But also, you know, regimes like the Israeli regime, especially the one led by Benjamin Netanyahu, does not always even think rationally, even in terms of their own interests. Yes, the interest is to obliterate, to flatten Gaza, to kill each and every Palestinian living in Gaza. But the blocking out of communication, they see it as part of that, but they do not understand that this is simply backfiring. It's making the Israeli regime yet again look like a regime that wants to close out each and every communication.
Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids on several areas of the occupied West Bank, including a refugee camp near Al-Quds. Regime troops clashed with Palestinians during a raid on Shufa camp. They abducted several of the Palestinians there. There was also an Israeli raid on the Balata refugee camp near Nablus. Military wing of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement says its fighters from Nablus confronted Israeli forces. Another Palestinian armed faction, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, also reported confrontation with regime troops there. Now, since October 7th, Israel's intensified its raids and arrests across much of the occupied territories. Regime forces withdrew from a refugee camp in the city of Tulkarm on Friday after raiding several locations there for almost 2 days. A raid left 8 Palestinians dead and left a trail of destruction.
The Israeli army comes to kill, not to detain or arrest wanted people. No, they come to kill young people, old people, animals, or inanimates. If they see a shadow of a cat, they'll kill it.
At the beginning of the raid, they entered this house and they stayed in it. There was a window there and they were observing through it. More soldiers joined them and they raided the area and destroyed houses.
Dozens of Palestinians have been abducted during a two-day raid onto a Karam refugee camp. According to an advocacy group, Palestinian Prisoners Club, some of those detained were severely beaten by Israeli forces. Since early October, Israel's military and settlers have carried out a number of incursions into different areas of the West Bank almost on a daily basis, killing and arresting Palestinians during these raids. According to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, 4 military advisors have been martyred there in an Israeli strike in the Syrian capital, Damascus. A 3-story home has been leveled. 5 fatalities have taken place. 4 of those seems like have been IRGC advisors there at the invitation of the Syrian government. As soon as we get the story developed, we'll get it out to you in your next broadcast. For now, it's a goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on December 27, 2023, a week before the birth anniversary of Lady Fatimatu Zahra, peace be upon her. This day is celebrated as Women's Day in Iran. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and his untainted, pure, chosen progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. A warm welcome to all the dear women here, my sisters, daughters, and children. You are all our children, and you are the builders of tomorrow's Iran and tomorrow's world. This meeting has been so profound and useful up until this moment. I would like to express my appreciation to all those who have taken part in the program. I would like to thank the girls who sang an anthem here today. Both the anthem, that is, the content of the anthem, and the melody were good, and their performance was very good. I would like to thank our honorable reciter of the Quran. I would also like to thank the honorable, eloquent announcer. I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to the wives of the martyrs, the mothers of the martyrs, and the children of the martyrs who are present in this gathering. I feel a great deal of esteem for all of them.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to thank Mrs. Zagzaki for speaking here today. She is the mother of six martyrs. Three of her sons were martyred in one tragic event, and her other three sons were martyred in another tragic event. This woman has been as patient as a mountain, and she endured many hardships and imprisonment for a long period of time. I would like to thank the Palestinian woman whose video we watched here today. Asra Al-Buhaisi, a reporter for Al-Alam, sent a video of herself reporting from Gaza. I ask those who are working in this area to express our appreciation and greetings to her, and to tell her that I always pray for them, the Palestinians, every single night. The issues that were raised here were very good. I mean, if I don't say anything now, and we just benefit from what these women said here, this meeting will still have been useful.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, you guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the 17th of January 1961, Patrice Lumumba, the great fighter for Congo's independence, was tortured and then executed. Western intelligence agencies, particularly America's CIA, and Britain's MI6 conspired with Belgium, the former colonizer of the country, and local traitors to overthrow and assassinate Lumumba. Now, this anti-colonial hero was only 35 years old and could have continued to play a very important role in the post-independence progress of his country and Africa. As the leader of the Congolese national movement, Lumumba was chosen by the people to lead an independent Congo emerging from brutal colonial rule under Belgium. An estimated 10 million people were killed during the barbaric colonial rule by this European power over Congo. Lumumba was determined to use the country's natural resources, which had been subject to decades of colonial and imperialist exploitation, for the benefit of the Congolese people. This is what angered Western powers, and they decided to eliminate him. The people of the Democratic Republic of Congo still languish in poverty, despite the country's enormous natural resources. Now, 63 years after the assassination of Lumumba, can this country rise and fulfill his dreams of prosperity for the nation and Africa as a whole? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are focusing on the legacy of Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese independence hero who was assassinated 63 years ago in an elaborate plot led by the notorious U.S. spy agency, the CIA, and Britain's MI6.
Remembering Patrice Lumumba. Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba was assassinated six decades ago, but his name remains synonymous with Africa's struggle against imperialism. His speech during the proclamation of Congo's independence in June 1960 angered Western powers, and this led to his eventual assassination.
To discuss the legacy of Patrice Lumumba, we have contacted Kambalaye Musavuli, a political analyst and a human rights activist. He's also the spokesperson for the Friends of the Congo. Thanks for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Gideon Balaike, the Secretary General of African Coalition for Development. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be part of this conversation.
Now, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and Britain's MI6 were the main conspirators with Belgium in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. So let's start off with Mr. Masavuli. Why did these Western imperialist colonial powers decide to sponsor this heinous crime?
One of the reasons, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons Patrice Lumumba was assassinated is because he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. He fought for the independence of the Congo, and it was clear that when Congo got its independence, that the resources of the land will benefit the Congolese, building infrastructure and providing opportunities to Congolese. That did not sit well with Dwight Eisenhower, the president of the United States at the time. This is at the height of the Cold War. Congo has cobalt. The United States needs cobalt for its military industry, and as many will remember, Dwight Eisenhower did have a speech on January 17, 1961, talking about the military-industrial complex. But what people would not know, even though he made the speech on January 17, 1961, that day he made that speech, his CIA operatives in the DRC killed, were participating in the killing of the first democratically elected leader of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba.
Lumumba's assassination came less than 7 months after independence. No doubt, this assassination impacted negatively on the ideals of national economic unity, economic independence, and pan-African solidarity that Lumumba had championed. Laurent Lumumba, the son of Lumumba, says his dad sacrificed his life for Congo and Africa.
The Congolese youth should maintain the struggle and fight for our values like my late dad. He chose to sacrifice for the country and Africa as a whole. He once said, if the Congo requires a martyr, then I will be the first one.
Now let's bring in Gideon Balaike. Can we say that this CIA crime shattered the hopes of millions of Congolese for freedom and material prosperity?
Yes, absolutely. The shadow of Lumumba still continue to be alive today. Even in the Congolese politics, there is a huge inheritance of that assassination that can be seen today in the Congolese politics. As you know, Lumumba was a revolutionary leader, a nationalistic leader, but he was not, a communist as if most of the Western his stakeholders wanted to tag him. Lumumba was just a revolutionary person who wanted something greater for the Congo. He was a visionary person because he saw the Congo of the future. And that was seen as a danger for people who had interest in the Congo, and that's why they ended up assassinating him, because they didn't want to have someone who has a critical thinking, someone who think about his people, someone who is a real patriot. They wanted people that could be easily manipulated. And that's why the CIA, in collaboration with Belgium, they assassinated Patrice Lumumba. But unfortunately, the United States government that controls the CIA has never been held accountable up to date. We need a reparation because they have a legacy in what is happening currently in the Congo.
Lumumba's old friend and Army Chief of General Staff, Mobutu, staged his first coup and dismissed both the President and the Prime Minister on September 14, 1960. The lesson here is that the destruction and plundering of African after independence cannot be possible without the collaboration of locals. Such collaboration continues to impact negatively on Africa.
Congolese people are clear about the imperialist. Congolese people are clear about people who want to subject them to inhumane conditions. They've always resisted any oppression. Unfortunately, the forces, the external forces, have been able to affect the situation in the Congo. Specifically for what you said about Mobutu, Joseph Mobutu, who was an aide to Patrice Lumumba during the independence movement, and then became the head of the Congolese army. Through the CIA, they were able to coach Mobutu to be able to take the reign of government in DRC, his first coup, where he dismissed both the president and the prime minister to have the military take control, was actually guided by the CIA. So, yes, there are local locals who are cooperating. They are a very small minority. They are back, they are financed, and they are provided the necessary support to be able to hold millions of people hostages. And this model still, unfortunately, exists still today, where Africans are still fighting to rid themselves of neocolonial agents of the West. And they will be successful as we continue in this struggle to defeat them so that the people can have a say in the decision-making process.
In June 2022, the Belgian government returned the remains of Patrice Lumumba to his family and purported to apologize for his murder. His son commented on this move.
Je ne peux pas dire, c'est la joie.
I can't say it's joyous, but it's positive for us. It's positive that we can finally bury one of ours.
Now, Mr. Baleke, was the return of Patrice Lumumba's remains and the so-called apology issued by Belgium enough to atone for these horrendous crimes?
They returned the thief of Patrice Lumumba. That was symbolic. You remember, he was burned out in acidic water and killed, assassinated. So the only remaining part was his teeth. And his family has been reclaiming that for years so that they could, you know, bury symbolically a part of the body for their father, Patrice Lumumba. So for the family perspective, that was, you know, that was something great. And we had to demand for that. And we need as well reparation overall politically, because the role Belgium played in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba continues to have repercussions up to date in the Congolese political sphere. And, you know, they misled the Congo, like they took the Congo out of a trajectory of progress and put it in a trajectory of corruption and manipulation and neocolonialism.
Belgium's King Philippe visited the Democratic Republic of Congo early June 2022, and as expected, he flatly refused to apologize for his country's brutal and inhumane crimes in the Congo. King Flip only offered what he termed as his deepest regrets for his nation's colonial-era genocide and extermination of millions of Congolese people, including women and children.
King Philip stopped short of apologizing for colonial-era atrocities angering the people of Congo and Africans across the world. Now, what's your take on this statement by the king?
Of course, it's okay to say apology, but Congo needs more than an apology. Congo needs reparation. So from King Leopold losing 10 to 15 million people to the colonial rule where Congolese had to fight World War I and World War II on behalf of Belgium, and they did not even get paid for that operations, right? That's still a contention. From the copper extracted from our land, from the uranium taken in the Congo, under Belgian hands, taken in the Congo, given to the Americans for the so-called Manhattan Project, and this uranium went to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. All that oppression, and to even colonize that and say that Congolese cannot be independent, Congo needs more than an apology. Congo needs reparation. And what does that mean? It means that any corporations from back then to now, we know the names, they still exist, must provide reparation to the Congolese. The Union Minière du Haut-Katanga, which still exists today under a different name in Belgium, made billions of dollars back then and continue to make billions today. And the states, right? That's the call, reparations. Need to be financial, materials, and also anything they have ever taken from the Congo must return to the DRC. Congo does not need only an apology. Congo needs reparation.
Thank you for that, Mr. Mosavole. Let's take a short break before we continue with our show on Patrice Lumumba, the Congolese independence hero who was brutally assassinated by Western colonial powers.
Remembering Patrice Lumumba.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. Our discussion is on the CIA-led assassination of Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba. Now, during the Cold War era, the United States, which claims to advocate for democracy, supported the most brutal African dictators. For instance, after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, the CIA installed Mobutu Sese Seko as the president who ruled Congo with an iron fist and even changed the name of the country to Zaire. Here is one of Mobutu's visits to Washington, where he met the then U.S. President Ronald Reagan.
And I am pleased to have been able to meet again with President Mobutu, who's been a faithful friend of the United States for some 20 years. The President and I took this opportunity to review the state of U.S.-Zairean relations, and we found a large area of agreement on the major points.
Now, Mr. Baleke, what's your opinion on U.S. double standards on democracy, where it assassinates a democratically elected president or leader like Lumumba and props up a dictator like Mobutu?
That's one of the greatest examples in the 20th century of the American foreign policy cynicism and neocolonialism, imperialism. We had a different context during those days with the Cold War. So it was an hegemonic war that was being played with African leaders.
The progressive forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo are struggling to ensure that the masses control and determine the affairs of the Congo. Patrice Lumumba gave his life so that the sons and daughters of the Congo would ultimately take ownership of the country's wealth for their benefit and for the benefit of Africa overall. A Congolese citizen here speaks on the anti-colonial legacy of Patrice Lumumba and how current leaders have betrayed this legacy.
Yeah, the left us a great legacy. That is working for the people and avoiding influence from Western countries. But we see since the Second Republic, our country is still being dominated by foreign powers.
Now, despite efforts by progressive forces in the Democratic Republic of Congo to eliminate neocolonial influence over the past few years, we have seen a marked increase of American special forces in eastern DRC. Now, Mr. Musavuli, what are these U.S. troops doing in these mineral-rich regions that continue to see deadly rebels roaming across with impunity?
In the context of the conflict in the Congo today, and with the Congolese government, Congolese military trying to have regained sovereignty over the land, they've had foreign militaries training, not just the United States, but different ones. But specifically for your question in terms of the United States, they've been engaged in military training, particularly in the northeast part of the Congo, where they've done training for Med Flag, beyond even the United States. Right now, Israel has been training the Congolese forces that we call the Republican Guard, right? Whereby in October 2003, it was reported that over 200 IDF forces who were training the Congolese army had to leave the DRC to go kill Palestinians, pretty much. They left the Congo to go fight in Gaza. They are training soldiers who are also committing human rights abuse. The United Nations report that was just released this December documented how the Republican Guard, trained by the IDF, killed civilians in numbers up to over 100, took their bodies and went to hide their bodies. This is documented in a UN report. And no consequences for the soldiers who committed these crimes. There have been a few who have been arrested, but no fundamental consequence in the chain of command that order for the killing of the civilians, and no accountability for the Israeli soldiers who train these troops. So the military training, unfortunately, is only reinforcing oppressive regimes in the Congo who, when these soldiers are trained, they are going to also harm the Congolese population, who are demanding the end of the conflict. They want peace, they want stability, and after two decades of war, we do not need more military presence, military training. What we need is accountability for crimes taking place and holding U.S. allies and Israeli allies on the African continent accountable.
According to diplomatic messages between Brussels and its former colony, Lumumba, the newborn republic's first prime minister, was a man to be eliminated. So there is no shadow of doubt that these assassins are well known.
The people of Congo believe that justice will one day be served, and those who assassinated Patrice Lumumba will pay for their heinous crime.
The biggest form of justice we could give to Patrice Lumumba as Congolese revolutionary is to perpetuate his legacy. And they killed Lumumba, but they didn't kill the idea of Lumumba. He was killed, but his idea has never been killed. And that's the greatest thing, you know. You could see Lumumba is a patriotic figure, not only in the Congo, but all across Africa. So he's still a symbol up to date of resistance against neocolonialism. And that's the greatest legacy. But I think the greatest achievement and the greatest gift we could give to Patrice Lumumba is to liberate the Congo from all the ashes of imperialism, to liberate the Congo from all corruption and incompetent leaders that are manipulated from Western or Eastern angles, is to liberate the Congo from all the bad things that are happening in the country and to make it a free, a really independent country, prosperous country that definitely work for the interest of all Congolese people who deserve to live into dignity. That's the best way to honor the memory of Patrice Lumumba.
Last month, the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo voted in a general election where the incumbent won. Felix Tshisekedi was re-elected as DRC's president for a second term, but the opposition contested these results due to numerous violations in the electoral process. This country has great potential and vast mineral and natural resources valued as an estimated $24 trillion.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has been facing political instability and armed violence since 1996, with an estimated 6 million people killed since the conflict began. Western tech giants continue to profit from Congo's conflict minerals while locals suffer. A Congolese civilian affected by conflict in the mineral-rich DRC speaks here on his suffering.
We have suffered a lot. Hunger, disease, death, women are raped, and the list goes on. We don't want this life of begging. At home, we had fields, cattle, and we lived very well. The most important thing is to stop the war so that we can return home.
Now, the dream of Patrice Lumumba was that Congo's immense natural resources should bring prosperity and peace for the Congolese. This dream is yet to be achieved. Mr. Musavule, you have the last word today. Now, is the current government of the DRC moving towards Lumumba's dream?
You clearly stated it. Now, Congo is the largest African country, the second largest African country by size after Algeria. And by population, is the fourth largest African country by population, right? And has so much wealth, mm-hmm. right, from its fauna and flora. From its resources on the ground, the minerals, the gold, the coltan, the tin, the cobalt, this mineral used in all these Tesla vehicles. Now, Congo is the number one producer of cobalt in the world, so you can't drive an electric vehicle without Congo's cobalt in it. It's virtually impossible. But this wealth is only benefiting the elites. The Congolese people are still in the pursuit of the ideals of Patrice Lumumba. This is why, since 2006, as you watch all the presidential elections, you still see Congolese protesting, organizing, saying that they want leaders who represent the will. So the Congolese people have not given up on the ideals of Lumumba. They are fighting. But what is important in their context of fighting to liberate the country?
Well, as our guest said, the people of Congo are still struggling to ensure that the aspirations of Patrice Lumumba are attained. I'd like to thank our guests, Kambale Musavule and Gideon Baleke, for their incisive analysis today.
My name is George Zongola Mpelaja, Professor of African Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I was asked by the Ohio University Press to write the book on Patrice Lumumba in a series of books on great African leaders. Patrice Lumumba was a young man who became the first Prime Minister of the Congo at its independence on June 30, 1960. His main goal as a national leader was to utilize the natural resources of the Congo, my country, to improve the living conditions of our people. The powers that be outside of Africa, namely in the United States and Western Europe, wanted to undermine democracy in the Congo in order to continue the control they had over our resources. Since they saw Lumumba as an obstacle to their own goals. They had to get rid of him.
And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world on The Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. This is Lantern. On the continuation of Lantern, we have an interesting story. Of course, after listening to this story, we have the speech of the scholar and the important points of this story. Ayatollah Burujerdi was one of the great marja in the Islamic world. It has been narrated about the spiritual station of the great marja Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Burujerdi that he had made a vow or nadr that if he ever uttered inappropriate words when angry, he would fast for a whole year to train his soul. Indeed, he had a very lofty station. He himself has said, "Before I came to the city of Qom, I used to hear the voices of the angels, but after I arrived here and became occupied and busy in the role of marja, I lost that blessing." Ayatollah Burujerdi had made a vow in order to train his soul that if he ever said something unbenefiting in anger, he would fast one whole year. One day he was sitting teaching a class in Burujerd. At these times he had a great presence and a special dignity. A student began to argue with him, and he answered his query. He raised another objection, which was also answered. However, when he objected a third time, Ayatollah Burujerdi became momentarily angry, and with an annoyed tone he said from the pulpit, "Be quiet, young man." However, realizing that he had done, as soon as he finished his class, he called that student, and in front of the whole class, he bowed and kissed his student's hand and gave him a cloak and 500 tumans, a reasonable amount in those days, and then said, "Forgive the mistake of Burujerdi. I do not understand how the reins of my soul slipped from my hands and why I ask you to be quiet in front of everyone." From the very next day, Ayatollah Burujerdi began to fast just for one harsh word, which in itself was neither backbiting nor a lie.
Mm-hmm.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to talk about some of the moral themes and lessons that we can take from these stories in order for us to make use of them as Shia, servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in our daily lives. Well, today we want to talk about one of the greatest contemporary Shia scholars, who is Ayatollah Burujerdi rahmatullah alayh. Ayatollah Sayyid Hussein Burujerdi was a 12-year Shia marja and a leading marja in Iran from roughly 1947 to his death, which was in 1961. He was born in the city of Burujerd in the province of Lorestan in Iran, which is significant in his surname, in fact. He was taught by scholars of this city and finished a good deal of his primary studies at the hand of his father. He immigrated to Isfahan in 1893 in order to continue his studies and acquire religious studies when he was 18 years old. He was tutored by senior scholars of Isfahan, such as the Grand Ayatollahs and those bearing the title of Hujjat al-Islam, such as Mirza Abu al-Ma'ali al-Kalbasi, Sayyid Mir Muhammad Taqi al-Mudarisi, Akhunda Mullah Muhammad al-Kashi, and Mirza Jahangir Qashqai. He also taught jurisprudence and usul during his studies in Isfahan. He migrated to Najaf in 1901 after 8 years of study and earning the degree of Ijtihad there. He was then 26 years old, and he benefited from attending classes by great Ayatollahs such as Akhunda Khorasani, who was the author of Kifaya, and Allama Yazi, who was the author of Al-Urwatul Wuthqa. He distinguished himself among the students of the late Akhund, for he wrote commentaries about his book that was Kifayatul Usul. Along with these, Ayatollah Burujerdi rahmatullah alayh studied under a number of other Shias, masters of Islamic jurisprudence, such as Muhammad Kadhim al-Khurasani and Aghazi al-Iraqi, and specialized in fiqh. He studied the fiqaha of all the Islamic schools of thought, not just his own, along with the science of Rijal. You know, the science of Rijal is some kind of historical science about the exact narrations. Though he is known for citing the infallible Imams alayhim as-salam or Ma'sumin to support many of his deductions, Ayatollah Burujerdi rahmatullah alayh is known for elucidating many aspects himself and is an influential fiqh jurist in his own right. He has had strong influence on Islamic scholars like Murtada Mutahhari. Okay, for now, let's just have a short break and we will be back very soon.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRIB English Radio, and we are talking about the biography of Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad al-Burujerdi rahmatullah alayh. Well, Ayatollah Burujerdi rahmatullah alayh was the first marja to look beyond Iraq and Iran. He sent Sayyid Muhaqqiqi to Hamburg, Germany, Agha Shari'at to Karachi, that is in Pakistan, and Al-Faqihi to Medina and Sayyid Musa Sadr to Lebanon. He established cordial relations with Sheikh Muhammad Shaltut, who was the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar. Together, the two scholars established the House of Bringing Muslim Sects Nearer in Cairo. Shaltut issued a famous fatwa accepting the Shia faith as one of the recognized sects of Islam.